You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 75 by Rudolf Steiner, 8 lectures/discussions, entitled Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences, translated by Sabine Seiler. This is Lecture 7, entitled Agnosticism in Science, given in Leipzig on May 11, 1922. Rudolf Steiner. Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me first of all to express my heartfelt thanks to the Association for Anthroposophical Academic Work for giving me the opportunity to give an introductory lecture here about the relationship of certain present-day characteristics of science to anthroposophy. In addition, I have to ask you, especially today, to keep in mind that in such a first introductory lecture, there is a certain difficulty, because much of what needs to be said about such a comprehensive topic can only be indicated in broad outlines, and thus I can only provide suggestions today that then have to be elaborated and explained in detail later. I will naturally not be able to address many of the questions that will pile up. In terms of relevance, today's topic also poses certain difficulties. The first one is that in large circles of the public today, a prejudice rears its head right away when people talk about any relationship between the sciences and anthroposophy. That widespread prejudice is that anthroposophy, as we mean it here, intends to take a stance in opposition to the sciences as they have developed historically in the course of the last few centuries, until they reached their peak in the last third of the 19th century, at least as far as their way of thinking and their methods are concerned. But it is not at all the case that anthroposophy is taking any such opposing position. For anthroposophy, as I mean it, strives instead to accentuate the best principles and foundations of modern scientific aims. Anthroposophy tries hard to further develop and expand what must be presupposed in terms of human views, scientific outlook, in order to bring about the recognition of precisely the established sciences. And in this further development, we will see that precisely from the sure foundations of the scientific way of thinking, as long as it is understood correctly and pursued for its living consequences and not just its logical ones, a way can be discovered that leads to those suprasensory realms of the world to which our being must feel connected in its eternal foundations. That is how, in a certain way, simply through the continuation of the principles of science, the path to the supersensory realms is to be found by means of anthroposophy. Of course, when I speak in your circle about the relationship of anthroposophy to the sciences, I will, to an extent, have to speak in such a way that you do not have to step out of what you are used to recognizing as scientific conscientiousness and the scientific way of thinking. But I will not talk about individual areas of science, but rather about the entire edifice of the sciences of our time. And because I must assume that some of you, dear students, are members of various areas of science, I will not be able to do justice to individual needs, and some things will have to remain at a level that looks abstract, even though it is not meant to be abstract. That is, from what I have to say, you will each have to draw the appropriate conclusions for yourself. Agnosticism is a word that, though not used much these days, designates something that is definitely connected with the fundamentals of our scientific way of thinking. This agnosticism as a justifiable scientific way of thinking, or better, philosophical way of thinking, was established by such persons as, for example, Herbert Spencer. He preferred to use that term. And if you are looking for a definition of agnosticism, you will have to look for it in his work. this agnosticism as a foundation, as a fundamental tone, in a manner of speaking, of scientific thinking, is prevalent in our time in the broadest areas of knowledge. If we want to express, at first quite abstractly, what is meant by agnosticism, we could say the following. The scientific methods that have developed and proven themselves as certain in the past several centuries are generally recognized. We apply these methods necessarily in the sciences to pursue them properly in certain areas today, namely through observation, through experiments, and through the conceptual processing of observation and experiment. By practicing science in this way, and I want to point out that in certain areas this is absolutely justified today, we arrive at the realization that we certainly can achieve much with science regarding knowledge of the laws that underlie the world. We then take pains to extend these laws, with which we have imbued ourselves in this way, to human beings, in order to attain what everyone with healthy thinking wants to acquire from knowledge. A view of the human being's position in the universe, of human destiny in the universe. And if we practice science in this way, we will come simply in the course of this scientific practice itself to the realization that indeed there are regularities and laws, but they actually relate only to the summary of external phenomena as they are given to the senses, or as they can be deduced if they are not evident to the senses, that is, deduced based on the material gathered through sensory observation. But what has been discovered in this way about nature and the human being can never extend to those realms that in older forms of human knowledge were considered the suprasensory foundation of the world, a foundation with which the deepest nature of the human being's eternal essence, if I may call it that, must also stand in a certain connection. It is precisely through the scientific point of view that we come to a recognition of what is unknowable to science, namely to certain limits or boundaries of scientific research. At best, we must realize that the human soul, our inner spiritual being, must be connected with something that cannot be accessed by science alone. That with which this inner being is connected simply cannot be researched scientifically. It belongs to the realm of the unknowable. What we are facing here is not Gnosticism, but agnosticism. And with this, contemporary intellectual life has set itself in opposition to what was still present at the time when Gnosticism was the prevailing attitude toward knowledge and was called Gnosis. Contrary to what some people believe, Anthroposophy, as we define it here, does not offer rekindled Gnosis. The latter cannot be resurrected. It was born out of the mindset of its time, in a sense, out of the science of its era. We are now in a new era, and if we want to establish a suprasensory basis for science, we must take into account what the activities of spirits such as Copernicus and Galileo, among many others whom I won't name now, have contributed to the development of humanity. Saying this also says implicitly that it is impossible to take the standpoint of Gnosis, which of course has nothing in common with modern science. But I still want to point out that this Gnostic standpoint, in a certain sense, was the opposite of what presents itself today as the keynote of science. According to the Gnostic standpoint, it was in fact very possible for people to move up to suprasensory realms if they turned to their inner powers of knowledge, which they were not using in ordinary life. What people would find in this way was not religion, but knowledge that could serve as a basis for religious life. Now, you will most readily understand what I have to say in this introductory lecture if I first remind you of something that you already know and that can point to the transformation undergone by the human cognitive process in the course of humanity's development. You all know about the changes that philosophy has undergone, just in regard to outer scientific life. Even in our era, philosophy still comprises the entire extent of what was scientific knowledge. Simply as a human activity, philosophy was something that was already and rightly indicated in its very name. Philosophy was not merely a product of the human intellect or merely based on observation and experiment, even though philosophy also extended, of course, to the results that could be attained by the intellect, observation, and even primitive experiments. Rather, philosophy was, to a much greater extent than our modern science, and again this is rightly so, something that came forth out of the whole human being. Philosophy grew out of a certain inner soul life and feeling relationship of human beings to the world. And in the era in which philosophy received its name, people had no doubt that they could achieve a certain objectivity in knowledge when they sought knowledge not solely through experiment, observation, and intellect, but applied other forces instead. We can give expression to these other forces with the same word we use to designate the love, in quotes, of something. And philosophy in the time of the ancient Greeks comprised everything we now include in the knowledge of nature. In the course of many centuries, what we now call the knowledge of nature developed out of philosophy. And this knowledge of nature has undergone an enormous transformation in recent times, indeed a transformation that has made it the foundation of practical life as we now experience it in the domain of technology. An impartial overview of the life of the sciences in our time will show us that what has made the sciences so extraordinarily great in recent times is what now underlies our practical life as technology. Our natural sciences have finally become what was said by Kant. As you know, I refer to Kant when he has said something I can acknowledge and agree with, even though I admit freely and everywhere that in many areas I am an opponent of Kant. Now, Kant said that real science can be found in the sciences only to the extent that mathematics can be found in them. This dictum has been acknowledged and accepted more and more in scientific practice, particularly in the natural sciences. We currently practice science by being aware of how we connect what we find in space and time through observation and experiment with what mathematics leads us to recognize through purely inner perception. And we feel especially certain and assured in our practice of science precisely because we are able to connect entirely inner knowledge, inner experience, such as we have in mathematics, with what we attain through observation and experiment. As we encompass what comes to us from the outside with the mathematical certainty we have in purely inner experience, we feel that in this cognitive process, we stand in a connection with the external world that allows us to experience sufficient scientific certainty. And starting precisely from the basis of the natural sciences, this is how we have increasingly come to see the exactness of science in the fact that we can justify our scientific work mathematically. Why are we doing this? Dear students, the answer is already contained in what I have just said. The answer is that in doing mathematics, we are active only within our own soul experience. That is, we remain entirely within ourselves. I think those who have especially dedicated themselves to studying mathematics will agree with me when I say that in regard to our inner experience, mathematics, or mathematizing, can give those who do it out of inner ability and talent, out of inner enthusiasm, if I may put it that way, much more satisfaction than all other knowledge of the external world. This is so simply because in doing mathematics, we are at every step of the way directly connected with what we attain as a scientific result. And when we are able to connect what we encounter from the outside with what we have entirely constructed ourselves. Then in this interweaving of what comes from the outside with the mathematical constructions we have developed, we feel something that we can be certain stands securely on a solid foundation. Because our science now allows us to connect the external with the inner experience through mathematics, we consider it a science, in the Kantian sense, as long as there is mathematics in that science. Now, at the same time, this opens up the way for a specific understanding of the world view we find in the natural sciences. This understanding, with all its consequences, is what anthroposophical research pursues. For what does it mean that we have come to such a view of our scientific knowledge? Having come to this understanding already implies the acknowledgement that we want to develop our thinking inwardly, and by doing so, we achieve a kind of certainty that allows us to apply our thinking to study the laws of outer phenomena, outer facts. This is the same principle that anthroposophy applies in the area where this principle is appropriate. By turning to what I want to call pure phenomenalism in regard to certain fields of the natural sciences, such as mechanics, physics, and chemistry, that is, in regard to everything that does not yet advance to life itself. And in an extreme sense, anthroposophy also holds to that phenomenalism for all areas above the level of the inanimate. But we will soon see the extent to which this phenomenalism must be supplemented in those areas with something fundamentally different. By considering the mathematical relationship to the outside world, we gradually realize that in the sciences of the inorganic realm, our thinking initially can have only a supporting character. We are not justified in contributing something to the world ourselves from our thoughts if we want to have pure science. This, however, leads to what is called phenomenalism. Even though this can be criticized in some details, it was implemented in its purest form by Goethe. Now, what is this phenomenalism? Phenomenalism consists in simply and purely grasping phenomena, whether by means of observation or experiment, just as they present themselves to our senses, and then applying thinking only to put the phenomena into a certain context or relation. That is, to line them up in such a way that they explain themselves. But this initially eliminates from the pure natural sciences everything that grasps hypotheses, not only as helpful constructions, but grasps them as if they could provide us with reality. When we stop at pure phenomenalism, we are justified in assuming, on the basis of our observations and experiments, that there is an atomistic structure, whether in the material world or in the world of forces. But this tendency to assume an atomistic structure must not be accepted when it can no longer be traced phenomenologically and can no longer be described by means of the phenomena. This principle is violated by the scientific worldview that constructs an atomism which then postulates something factual behind the sense-perceptible phenomena, something that is itself not part of the world of phenomena. For example, this occurs when we do not examine the world of colors spread out before us by lining up the colors next to each other in order to arrive at the law of the connection between the colors. Instead, we move on from the phenomenon to something lying behind it, that is not regarded as just an auxiliary structure, but as something real. For example, people move beyond the phenomena by assuming that there are vibrations or the like in the ether, and in this way, thinking is extended beyond the phenomena. Here, out of a certain lethargy in thinking, people pierce the tapestry of the sensory world and postulate a world of whirling atoms or the like behind it. There is no reason to do this with the kind of thinking that wants to be only a servant or aid in lining up the phenomena in order to find the immanent lawful connections between phenomena, a kind of thinking that cannot say anything about what is imagined to lie behind this world of the senses. It is anthroposophy that takes the tendency of modern natural science to its ultimate consequence. Indeed, the modern natural sciences have recently arrived at a development of this phenomenalism, which, while not yet widely admitted theoretically, has found practical application. This development results when the sciences ignore the hypothetical worlds of atoms and instead stop with the phenomena themselves and do not go beyond them. But stopping with the phenomena has a specific result, namely the consequence is that we then really come to agnosticism. When we use our thinking merely to line up phenomena, to arrange them in an orderly fashion, we will never arrive at the human being as such. Merely sorting and arranging phenomena and identifying their laws will not lead us to the human being. And that is the peculiar thing we have to admit. When we follow the path of the natural sciences to its logical, justified conclusion, and arrive at pure phenomenalism, without postulating unfounded hypotheses about what is behind the tapestry of the sensory world, we come inevitably, without fail, to agnosticism. But where knowledge is concerned, this agnosticism is now something quite different from what humanity, in the course of its development, of its history, has actually hoped for from knowledge and sought through knowledge. Well, I don't want to lead you right away into remote suprasensory regions, though I will indicate them later. But I would like to point out something here to show you that even in ancient times the understanding of knowledge was quite different from what knowledge can become when we continue to work conscientiously on the basis of the natural sciences. Allow me to refer again to Greek antiquity, a time when all sciences were still combined in philosophy. Surely we all share a deep reverence for Greek art, for example, for what lives in Greek tragedy, just to mention one thing. Regarding Greek tragedy, much has been said about its catharsis, which has been called its most important component, about the crisis, the crucial element that lives in tragedy. When we build on what the ancient Greeks experienced in tragedy, an important question arises, a question that leads us deep into the essence of the process of knowing. In the abstract definition of catharsis that is based on Aristotle, tragedy is said to evoke fear and pity in the audience so that the human soul, by having these or similar passions arise within it, can be cleansed of such passions. Though I can only point this out here, evidence for this fact can readily be found through the ordinary sciences. That is, the fact that everything we have in Greek tragedy, including the thinking about the artistic crisis of catharsis, was closely connected with the medical thinking of the time. What happened in the human soul during a tragedy was considered a healing process that had been raised to the level of dramatic art, in order to heal something pathological in the human being. That is, from knowing how the ancient Greeks understood their art, we can infer how they understood the healing process, therapeutic treatment. The way the ancient Greeks understood healing is that they assumed that something pathological had formed in the diseased organism, and the organism then waged a battle. In this introductory talk, I can, of course, only describe this in abstract terms, against what had formed there. Through its excretions, the human organism overcame the disease process. That is how what is pathological in the organism was vanquished. This is what the ancient Greeks thought regarding pathology and therapeutic treatment. And this is also how they thought regarding the artistic process, only on a higher level. What the tragedy was doing to the spectators was considered a sort of healing process for the soul. Just as in the case of a catarrh, the residue of the illness must come out of the organism, so by watching a tragedy, the soul was to develop fear and pity within itself, and then take up the struggle against these excreted products and experience a healing process by suppressing them. We understand the fundamentals of this way of thinking only when we know that already in ancient Greece, in Hellenism, a Hellenism that was in certain ways a healthy one, the view already existed that if human beings are left to follow only their own nature regarding their soul development, then this will always lead to a sort of illness, and that the spiritual life in human beings must be a continual healing process. Those who are more intimately familiar with this aspect of Hellenism will not hesitate at all to agree that the ancient Greeks envisioned their highest spiritual life as a remedy against the perpetual tendency of the soul toward withering away. That is, the ancient Greeks saw their spiritual life as a way of counteracting death. For the Greeks, spiritual life consisted in reviving the soul in the direction of its essence. Thus, for them, their sciences were not just abstract knowledge, but something that stimulated a healing process within them. With a somewhat different nuance, the same view was also held by the worldviews that were based primarily on Judaism, and that talked of the fall and of original sin. The ancient Greeks also had the view, only with slightly different nuances, that it is necessary for the human soul to devote itself in life to a continuous healing process. Indeed, in the spiritual and cultural life of ancient Greece, people did not separate the activities they devoted themselves to and the way of thinking they cultivated into two distinct spheres. Rather, all these flowed together and merged. Therefore, for the ancient Greeks, the art of healing was indeed an art, but one that did not extend beyond nature. And it was precisely art that the ancient Greeks, who were eminently artistic people, considered as something that was not profaned or dragged down to a lower sphere by being compared with the process of healing the nature and essence of the human being. So, we see that in those ancient times, knowledge was not separate from human nature as a whole, and included all human activities. Just as philosophy back then also encompassed the knowledge of nature, as well as everything that is now emerging from the sciences, as they have been increasingly developed, so philosophy also included the artistic life. And people saw their religious life as the comprehensive, grand healing process of humanity. Thus, when we look at knowledge in the way people did in ancient times, we have to say that knowledge back then was seen as something that comes out of the entire human being, the human being as a whole. Thinking already existed, of course, but humanity could not stop at that phase of cognitive development. What was it that was necessarily connected with that phase in the development of cognition? The answer is very clear. When equipped as we are with the scientific spirit of today, we delve, I would say as an experiment, into any work that, let's say, in the 13th or 14th century, was considered scientific, insofar as the natural sciences are concerned. If we want to understand such a work, we must not only familiarize ourselves with the terminology, but also must immerse ourselves in its spirit as a whole. I don't hesitate to claim that if we are imbued with today's spirit of science, and have not first engaged in sincere and intimate historical studies, then we will unavoidably misunderstand works on the natural sciences dating from the 13th and 14th centuries AD, simply because even at that time, and the further back we go in human history, the more it is the case. People did not only bring mathematics to bear the outside world, but also a whole host of inner experiences in which they believed as much as we believe in our mathematics. For example, nowadays, when we speak as chemists of sulfur, phosphorus, or salt, we address nature quite differently than people did in the past when they talked about sulfur or salt. When we use our contemporary concepts, we do not in any way express the meaning that was intended back then in scientific books. For in the past, more than just mathematics was brought to bear on the results obtained from the observation of the external world. People back then carried a whole host of inner experiences, not only quantitatively, but also qualitatively, into the external world. Just as in the natural sciences we express a result in a mathematical formula and seemingly connect subject with object, so people back then also connected subject with object. But in those days the subject was filled with a richness we cannot even imagine today. And even if we still possessed this richness, we would not be permitted to carry it in the same way into nature. In those past times, people saw in nature much of what they themselves had put into it, just as we now put mathematics into nature. In antiquity, people did not think in any way differently about nature than we do, but they read much into it. And with that, they also read into nature what is moral. People saw what is moral in nature, so that in the course of 4 millennia, moral laws came into being for them in the same way as the laws of nature did. People who projected out into nature what in ancient times was understood by the terms salt, sulfur, phosphorus, and so on, could also project into nature what they experienced as moral impulses, and they could do so because inwardly they were doing the same thing in both cases. Now, we have broken away from this view of the external world, through which we project into it all those things I indicated. And that break was right, because this development had to happen. Now we introduce only mathematics into the external world. And as a result, our sciences have become a sound basis for technical practice. But because we introduce only mathematics into the external world, we have no right anymore to place what is moral into the realm of objectivity by means of our sciences. In fact, precisely if we proceed scientifically in the sense that has developed in the course of the past several centuries, we must necessarily lapse into a moral agnosticism. For we have no alternative but to see moral principles as only a matter of the subject, as something of which we cannot claim that it arises from nature in the same objective way as the natural processes themselves. And so, we must of necessity ask ourselves what foundation we have for moral science, and thus also for spiritual science and the social sciences, in a time when we legitimately must acknowledge phenomenalism, where external nature is concerned. That was the big question I faced at the time when I was writing titled The Philosophy of Freedom. Concerning what can be explored of the external sensory world through the process of knowledge, I stood firmly, through and through, on the foundations of modern natural science, indeed on phenomenalism. Now, if we follow that line of thought in all honesty to its logical conclusion, we have to admit that if we are to find an objective basis for morality, we must be able to place next to the knowledge that leads to phenomenalism, and thus to agnosticism, another kind of knowledge. That other knowledge must be one that does not use thinking to concoct hypothetical worlds behind the sensory phenomena. Instead, it must be the kind of knowledge that can grasp the spiritual directly in contemplation. Now that the spiritual is no longer introduced into the outside world in the former way. It is precisely agnosticism that compels us, on the one hand, to acknowledge it in its own sphere, and on the other hand, to rouse our spirit to activity, so that we can grasp a spiritual world where, if we want to go beyond the subjective element, we can find the moral principles through objective spiritual observation. My book, titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, has been labeled Ethical Individualism, and to some extent rightly so, but this only captures one aspect of it. Readers aside, those are two different titlings of the same book. One is The Philosophy of Freedom, and the other is The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity. End of readers aside. We must naturally arrive at an ethical individualism, because what we now see as moral principles must be perceived by each individual in freedom. Just as mathematics is developed as pure knowledge in an inwardly active intellectual process and still proves itself objectively solid, so the content of our moral impulses can also be grasped in purely spiritual contemplation, not just through faith, but through purely spiritual contemplation. And that is why we have to say, as I did in my title, Philosophy of Freedom, that moral science must be established on the basis of moral intuition. As I said back then, we can come to true moral intuition in the modern way only if we realize that just as we isolate the individual natural phenomena out of the totality of nature, we must likewise isolate out of a directly perceived spiritual world, out of a supra-sensory spiritual world, objectively grasped moral principles. Principles that we perceive only spiritually, but that are nevertheless independent of us. Thus I initially spoke about moral intuition. This gives the process of knowledge a certain direction. Especially when the process of knowledge is to remain truly scientific, the soul is compelled to gather all its forces and to carry this inner strengthening so far that the perception of a spiritual world becomes possible. The question then arises, is that which we grasp in the form of moral impulses the only thing that can be perceived in the spiritual world? Or is that which leads us to our moral intuitions only one region among many? The answer follows when we understand the inner experiences of our soul as moral intuitions, and then continue accordingly. What the soul experiences in gathering its forces for the purely spiritual apprehension of morality, something that has only become necessary in modern times because of the natural sciences, those same experiences can now also be undergone in other spheres. Thus, when we have achieved self-observation of this inner experience that leads to moral intuition, we can in fact develop this inner experience further. The exercises you find in my book, titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, help with this further development. With these exercises, we do not stop at thinking, using it to form hypotheses, but instead we can look at this thinking in its vitality and develop it further into what I will explain in more detail during the second part of my lecture, and what can be called exact perception of the suprasensory world. What I mean here is not the mystical vision of ancient times. That sort of vision has been lost. Rather, what I mean is an exact perception of the suprasensory world in accordance with the sciences, what may be called an exact clairvoyance. In this way, we then advance step by step to those forms of cognition I characterized here recently in a public lecture, namely to imagination, inspiration, and higher intuition, forms of cognition that light up our inner being. As regards the question of how we can establish a moral science, and thus also social sciences, on an objective foundation, especially when we are firmly rooted in the natural sciences, I wanted to show you with my introductory remarks, first of all, that if we are firmly anchored in modern science and yet are to turn toward life, the life that simply must be there for human beings who want to achieve inner wholeness, then we are impelled toward spiritual research. This research differs from ordinary research in that the latter simply uses those soul forces that are already at its disposal in order to extend its reach over the wide field of observations and experiments. In contrast, anthroposophical research first of all turns to human beings with the goal of developing within them higher soul forces, which, when developed exactly, lead us to a higher perception. This perception is then added in the supersensory realm to what we find in the sensory realm by way of the exact methods of the natural sciences. How this higher seeing is developed, and how we can advance from the sensory to the supersensory realm outside the sphere of morality, all this will be the subject of my talk after the break. And then there is a short break, and again, Rudolf Steiner. Ladies and gentlemen, the first stage of suprasensory cognition is achieved through what we may call meditation in connection with a certain concentration of our thought life. I explained the essential point in my previous public lecture here in Leipzig from one perspective. Today I want to characterize this from another perspective in such a way that we also find the way to a scientific comprehension of the world. The essential nature of this meditation, combined with the concentration or focus of our thinking, is precisely that we do not stop at that use of thinking which has developed through heredity, the usual upbringing, and so on. Instead, at a certain point in our mature life, we must take this thinking that we have acquired as the starting point for our further inner development. As you know, there are mystical people in our time who view thinking with a certain contempt, and who resort to all kinds of other, more or less subconscious, forces of cognition in order to arrive in this way at a sort of worldview that supposedly includes all that ordinary thinking cannot access. What we mean by anthroposophy has nothing to do with such a dreamy, fantastic immersion in an inner soul life, an immersion that verges on the pathological. On the contrary, what we mean by anthroposophy moves in the opposite direction. In anthroposophical research, every step on the path to the further development of thinking, to its transformation into a higher capacity, can be observed with the same inner, free, calm clarity we usually have only in observing the inner soul experiences that develop in such calm cognitive activities as the ones mathematicians cultivate. Thus we can say, we are taking precisely that thinking as our model that we modern human beings have developed in our scientific training, namely mathematical thinking, and we use it not only to seek some outer connections, but to develop a higher thinking process as such. If I may speak by way of an image, what mathematics undertakes in the horizontal plane, we undertake in the vertical direction, in that we carry out an inner soul activity, a soul exercise, in such a way that we account for every step, just as we do in the steps of mathematics. And we do this by controlling our thoughts and focusing our consciousness on a certain content of the imagination that is to be simply the content of our thoughts. What matters is not really the content itself. Instead, what matters is what we do with it. We should not somehow suggest something to ourselves. Indeed, anthroposophical exercises are the opposite of all those more unconscious soul activities. When we take the form of thinking we have already acquired and further develop it by resting with our entire soul activity on a clear, easily comprehensible content, and when this resting with a certain soul activity, this attention to that soul activity, to the exclusion of everything else that can ordinarily enter our soul, is repeated again and again, then our thinking process is strengthened. And it is only then that we notice what, in the manner of speaking, was the good or positive side of materialism, of the materialistic worldview. For it is only then that we notice how all the thinking we do in our ordinary life, namely the thinking that continues in our memory, enables us later to retrieve, by means of our memory, what we have experienced in our thoughts. We then notice that human beings can experience everything that happens between birth and death only by using the body as their foundation. I don't want to say that the body is used as a tool, but it serves as the foundation or substrate. And it is precisely as we push our thinking further through inner development that we become aware that our ordinary thinking is indeed bound to the physical organism, to the body. In particular, the memory process cannot be explained without the help of a finer physiology. For only now do we realize that thinking is freeing itself from the body, that it is becoming increasingly free of the body. Only now do we ascend from a thinking that takes place with the assistance of the body to a thinking that takes place in inner soul processes. Only now do we realize how we are gradually moving on to this kind of inner experiencing, how it has not yet arrived, but I would like to say, how it is preparing to emerge. When we transition from the ordinary waking state of consciousness into sleep consciousness, our organism simply no longer carries out the functions that are usually manifested in thinking and in the perception connected with that thinking. Because in ordinary life we can think only with the help of the body, thinking ceases the moment it is no longer supported by the body, that is, the moment we fall asleep. The last vestiges of thinking still appear in the thinking in images that characterizes our dreams. But when we again and again use exact inner exercises and thus advance our thinking ever further, we begin to realize the possibilities of a thinking that is independent of corporeality, of the body. Of course, as I said, this requires an exact clairvoyance as opposed to dark mystical clairvoyance. As a result of the exercises I mentioned, anthroposophical researchers can point with such inner certainty to their developed thinking because they understand, even more so than the materialists, that our ordinary thinking is dependent on our physical organization. And anthroposophical researchers experience how the soul lifts itself up out of its dependence on the body when we meditate and carry out those exercises. In other words, we learn to make our thinking free of the body and to step outside the body with our I being, capital. In doing so, we come to know the body as an object, while previously it had been completely bound up with subjectivity. This is what those involved in education these days find it difficult to acknowledge, although modern science has discovered what has been revealed and continues to be revealed more and more through anthroposophical knowledge, namely, that thinking is bound to the functions of the body. Nevertheless, there is no doubt that we must not stop at this realization about thinking, but must detach this thinking from the body by inwardly strengthening it through meditation. When we do that, this thinking is transformed. At first it is like this. When this body-free thinking flares up, and you experience being engaged in a soul activity that is like pulling yourself out of the body, then your thinking becomes inwardly more intense. Thinking then develops the same richness we usually experience only in sensory perception. Thinking then becomes vivid and pictorial, while still remaining as calm and deliberate as any thinking that is bound to the body. But once freed from the body, thinking becomes vividly pictorial. We think in forms and structures, which is the very same kind of thinking that was also present in its early stages in what Goethe developed in his morphology. That is why Goethe maintains that he can see his ideas with his eyes. Of course, he did not mean with physical eyes, but rather with what developed in him in an elementary natural process. This can also be developed by way of meditation. What Goethe meant was that he could see with his spiritual eyes, in quotes, what was just as pictorial as our sensory perceptions, but at the same time had an inner thought-like quality. I deliberately say thought-like, not thought, because what I'm talking about here is a more developed, metamorphosed thought, and thus thought-like. In this way, we advance to the knowledge of what we are as human beings in our earthly life, at least up to the present moment. Our ordinary consciousness is aware of the present moment and all the experiences in our environment. Even in ordinary science, we have this before us, as well as what arises in addition to this, namely the memories that emerge like thoughts and that we connect with our experiences in the present moment. The pictorial thinking to which we advance, and which I just discussed, is independent of the body and encompasses our earthly life up until now as one unit, standing before us as a tableau. I call this thinking imaginative thinking, not because it is a delusion, but because it takes place in pictures and not in abstractions. We then realize that in addition to the spatial organism, we also have a time organism within us, an organism for which before and after stand in just as organic a relationship as side by side does in the outer physical spatial organism that we carry with us everywhere. We recognize this time organism as a suprasensory one, and in my books I have called it the etheric body. But we can also call it the life body. What this body comprises is not identical with what earlier sciences have unjustifiably assumed to be a, in quotes, life force. That early science arrived at this life force only by way of an hypothesis, but our developed imaginative thinking encounters this life body as a reality. What our ordinary consciousness regards as things of the past in our inner experience, for example, as something experienced 10 years ago and now recalled to memory, all this appears in the imaginative thinking not as past, but as immediate present. We look at such experiences with the same intensity with which we look at something standing before us in the present moment. And in this way, what usually runs its course in time appears before us in a momentary unity. Our whole life is one picture, a picture whose parts inwardly belong together. We realize then that in reality what is past is also present, and only appears to be past, because in the moment, our cognition, tuned to the current observation, only experiences it as a memory. In objective terms, however, the past is something immediately present, something real. In this way, we come to acknowledge the first suprasensory element within the human being. And we also come to acknowledge something in our living environment that the inorganic natural sciences, right up to chemistry, cannot provide. That is, we come to a vision that is the further development of Goethean morphology. We see how individual plant forms are only particular distinct designs of one and the same form that underlies all plants. This is what Goethe called the archetypal plant, which is not a cell, but a concretely shaped suprasensory form that can only be grasped by imaginative cognition. The archetypal plant lives, modified, metamorphosed, in every individual plant. We come to the recognition of what we find in the realm of plants if we want to grasp that realm fully, and in this context, we have to admit that if we do not develop this imaginative cognition that reveals to us the suprasensory dynamic element in all plants, then we can only come to know the mechanical, physical, and chemical processes that occur in plants. It is to the credit of modern natural science, for example, in botany, that it examines purely the mechanical, physical, and chemical processes that take place in plants, or, more precisely put, in the spatial element enclosed by the plant form. These processes are the same ones that are also taking place outside in the physical world, but they are grasped by something that cannot be understood with the methods of physics or chemistry. Rather, these processes are grasped by something real and suprasensory that is knowable only for the imagination, the same imagination in which we also find ourselves in a single moment, standing there before us in our entirety, with the experience of our whole earthly life from birth to the present. Through this we learn, on the one hand, why precisely the application of the methods that have developed in the modern natural sciences must inevitably bring us to a certain agnosticism regarding our understanding of the plant kingdom. That is, we see that agnosticism is necessary in some areas. And we can also see to what extent anthroposophy adds something that must remain unknown to that agnosticism. You see, anthroposophy leads us beyond that agnosticism, while allowing it to exist as fully justified in its own sphere. That, my friends, is the one thing I wanted to tell you. Now, the other thing is that on this level we attain a closer link between our being and the outside world. In our time, physics, mechanics, and chemistry, for example, are pursued in such a way that we inject as little of any human element into this external world as possible, and rightly so. We take as our motto that only where we refrain from anything subjective do we have objectivity. Of course, anthroposophy does not want to challenge the legitimacy of this method in certain areas, but rather is keen to acknowledge it. Now, with what we come to know in the imagination, we can then grasp and contemplate what also lives in the plant kingdom. And then we arrive, on the one hand, at an intimate knowledge of our own suprasensory essence, at least as it exists between birth and death. And on the other hand, we also arrive at an understanding of what fluctuates and metamorphoses itself in the living world of forms. And through this we connect ourselves as human beings at this first stage in our imagination with the outside world. That is, we reinsert the human element into our worldview again. The next stage of suprasensory knowledge is inspiration. We achieve this level by developing what I want to call the counterpole or antithesis to meditation and concentration. If you have practiced meditating and concentrating for some time, you know that as you have strengthened your thinking, you have at the same time had the inner inclination to come to a standstill in that part of the soul where thinking is strengthened. Indeed, leaving behind those strengthened imaginative thoughts takes more effort than leaving behind any other thoughts. But once you become able to cast these strengthened thoughts out of your consciousness again, to expel, so to speak, this entire imaginative world that you yourself have developed in the first place, thus emptying your consciousness, then you will see that this emptiness of your consciousness, after you have initially strengthened it inwardly, is something quite different from the emptiness of consciousness according to the ordinary standpoint, in ordinary life, where emptiness of consciousness is sleep. In contrast, the emptiness of consciousness that follows after we have first strengthened our consciousness and then cast out the imaginative world again, that emptiness is soon filled again with the phenomena of a world that is very different from what we have known before. Now we come to know a world to which we can no longer apply our usual concepts of space and time. This world we are coming to know is a real soul, spiritual, external world, and is just as concrete as the real sensory world around us. But this soul, spiritual world can flow into us only if we have first emptied our consciousness on a higher level. After we have arrived at the level of imagination, by concentrating on a specific inner content, and have become capable of perceiving while outside the body, because we have activity within us, not just the passivity that is typical for our ordinary consciousness, and because we have undergone the pertinent preparations, then the spiritual outer world can now enter through the advanced, developed activity of the freed-up consciousness, much like the phenomena of the world of color or of sound enter into us through our senses. On the one hand, this spiritual outer world leads us to the knowledge and perception of what we were as human beings before we descended out of the spiritual soul world into the physical world. That is, before we united ourselves with a physical human embryo that was being prepared through conception in our mother's womb. We come to see what initially lived in a spiritual soul world and then united itself with the physical being of the individual. We come to know that part of ourselves which is basically completely ineffective and inoperative between birth and death, and is thus in a way excluded from our sensory life. But that part was active within us and worked in its purity before we descended into physical embodiment. That is one thing I wanted to explain. And then we come to know the human being more deeply as we advance to the second stage of suprasensory knowledge. This level must be developed with as much precision as the previous one, the imaginative stage, and this new knowledge, through which a spiritual world flows into us, just as pure air in the outer world flows into our lungs and is then processed further. This knowledge, which is only subconscious, insofar as our ordinary consciousness is concerned, but is fully conscious and further processed by the advanced consciousness, this flowing or streaming in of that spiritual world is what I have taken the liberty of calling inspired cognition. That is the second stage. At this second stage, we first come to know our eternal being as something pre-existing. And this allows us to advance to what not only lives, but lives and feels in the outside world, what manifests and expresses itself in the living shaping of the inner life in such a way that this inner life becomes present to itself in feeling. We thereby first come to understand the animal nature that lives all around us. In other words, on this level, we add to our knowledge what we could never attain through ordinary perception, as it has been developed in physics and chemistry. We come to perceive the higher suprasensory element that lives in those beings who feel and perceive. In fact, we learn now to observe a new higher world through direct perception, not just through philosophical hypotheses in the modern sense. This is the spiritual soul world present in that part of the physical world that experiences sensations and feelings. With this, we move further away from agnosticism. When we simply observe the chemical processes in our sensing and feeling being, agnosticism must of necessity and unavoidably be there. We must observe those processes, and indeed it is to the great credit of the modern natural sciences that we can observe them. But in doing so, the modern natural sciences must inevitably turn into agnosticism. The latter must be supplemented, and this occurs when we learn through inspiration in free spirituality what must be added so that we can arrive at the full reality of sensing and feeling life. And in this process, we also achieve something else of which I want to give you an example. You see, we come to realize that the process that runs its course within human beings, for animals the case is similar, is not only an ascending one, but also at the same time a descending one. It is only at this point, as we advance to inspired cognition, that we learn to look closely at ourselves inwardly. Only now can we realize what is going on in our ordinary consciousness. Above all, we learn that the thinking process that runs its course in our ordinary consciousness, not the imaginative consciousness, is actually not a process of building up, but rather one of breaking down. That is, the life of our nerves is one of dismantling, breaking down. If our nerves could not be broken down, and of course also be built up again from time to time, we could not develop our ordinary thinking. When it appears in excess, our actual vital life essentially numbs our thinking, as is the case every time we go to sleep. The life that is permeated by feeling and thinking must at the same time carry a breakdown process within it, a differential process of dying, as I would like to call it. We encounter this breakdown process initially in healthy life, that is, in the life where this process occurs to make it possible for human thinking, in the ordinary sense of the word, to come about in the first place. Once we understand the nature of these processes, we can also recognize when they occur abnormally. There simply are certain organs or organ systems in the human body in which processes take their course parallel to ordinary thinking. Now, when those breakdown processes, that are usually the physical foundation of thinking, extend through a sort of inner infection, this term is not meant in its original sense, to those organs to which they are not usually allocated, then illnesses develop in those organs. It is indeed necessary that we develop pathology to the point where we can find again, in pathology, the processes we know from physiology. This is only possible if we can gain insight into the essence of these processes in our human organization. To make sure that I am not misunderstood, I want to point out again that where organization of animals is concerned, the case is similar, though slightly different. As we observe the processes in the human organism, we see that one pole consists of an organization arranged for breaking things down, while the opposite pole, in its healthy condition, cannot be affected by the breakdown process. In our inspired cognition, we come to understand what is responsible for building up and what is responsible for breaking down. When we understand this and then connect this understanding of our organism with the inspired cognition of the outer world, of the processes in the plant kingdom, in the mineral kingdom, in the animal kingdom, then we also come to understand those kingdoms through inspired cognition. As a result, we recognize the kinship between the human inner processes and the outer world, a kinship that is even more intimate than the one that existed earlier at an earlier stage of humanity's history. I have shown that at that earlier stage, human beings felt a kinship with outer nature, because they saw in what appeared in the various metamorphoses in the plant kingdom something they also found in their soul, in the life between birth and death. Now, as people also see through inspired cognition, what they were in a pre-existing life, they gain insight into the outer world, not only into what lives in feeling and sensing, but also into what has a certain relationship to what lives in the human organization, which is oriented toward sensing and feeling, toward thinking. In this way, people learn about the connections between the processes outside and the processes within, as well as the connections with their life of sensing and feeling. We come to know what is produced in human beings when the breakdown process takes hold of organs that should not actually be taken hold of by that process, because that breakdown must only serve as the foundation for the thinking and sensing processes. When the organic activity for thinking and sensing takes hold of members of the human organism that should not be taken hold of in this way, then what develops is what we must examine in pathology. When we apply the same kind of thinking to the outer world, we find what must be dealt with in therapy. We find the relevant process of the polar counteraction, what I want to call the normal breakdown process inside us. In short, through inner perception, we find the connection between pathology and the therapeutic treatment, between the process of illness and the remedy. This leads us beyond agnosticism in medicine, not by negating current medical science, but by acknowledging what it can be. And in this way, we find at the same time the way to provide the supplement to medicine that it cannot find on its own. If anyone believes that anthroposophy seeks to cultivate any sort of dilettantism in any of the various fields of science, I must say that is not the case at all. Anthroposophy consciously seeks to be the continuation of what it fully acknowledges as the results of modern science, but it seeks to do so by adding the methods of higher knowledge. Anthroposophy seeks to advance beyond the shortcomings of the trial-and-error approach to therapy, shortcomings felt by everyone who works practically in the field. What anthroposophy seeks to arrive at is therapy that is developed on the basis of direct observation and experience, therapy that has an inner, organic connection to pathology. This therapy is, in a sense, just the other side of the pathology. When you can see in pathology simply the continuation of physiology, by realizing the kinship between human beings and their natural environment, then you can also continue the pathology in a fully rational way into treatment therapy. As a result, pathology and therapy do not have to continue standing separately side by side, as they now do in the modern sciences tinged with agnosticism. These are only indications of what I want to give you because they can show, at least to some extent, and I know how imperfect everything is in an introductory talk such as this, that anthroposophy does not at all, in some dilettantish way, want to oppose the established and recognized sciences. Instead, what anthroposophy is concerned with is taking the agnostic form of science to its final logical conclusion, and in this way coming to see and know what must be added to that science. Indeed, many people already sense that the sciences as they are now are not sufficient, and especially the younger generation feels this insufficiency. They feel that they need something more, that the sciences as they are not enough for them. Precisely if our intentions regarding the sciences are serious and sincere, we must advance through them to something else. And anthroposophy wants to be there, especially for those who see the sciences not just as an answer, but rather, in a higher sense, as a question. Anthroposophy does not mean to push the sciences into dilettantism, but instead to proceed from them in the correct and exact way to what, if they are followed to their logical conclusion, the sciences themselves demand. Now, there is a third stage of knowledge, and we reach that when we extend our exercises to include exercises for the will. We use the will primarily to carry out what we can do in the outer world. When we apply that same energy of the will to our inner processes, then a third stage of suprasensory knowledge arises on the foundation of imagination and inspiration. If we are really honest with ourselves, we have to admit at every moment of our life that we are quite different today from what we were 10 or 20 years ago. The content of our soul has changed, and while it changed, we were completely, passively surrendered to the outside world. Thus, in particular, in regard to our inner transformation, a certain passivity holds sway in us. But we can take this transformation into our own hands and become capable of radically changing something in us that has, in a way, become habitual. Of course, only where such a change seems possible. That is, we can inwardly act toward ourselves in such a way that we transform ourselves in a certain direction through our own will, and as a result become a different person. For this purpose, we must actively strengthen our inner experiencing for years, often for decades, because such will exercises take time. For example, to do this, you may decide to develop a certain character trait or its manifestation in yourself. After a few months, you will notice how little headway you are making in shaping yourself compared to how your body shapes you otherwise. But if you continue and make more and more of an effort, then you not only see your inner supra-sensory being, but become capable of making this inner being completely transparent, as it were. For example, our eyes as sensory organs could not serve us as organs of sight if they were not selfless, if I may use this expression. That is, if they did not, in a way, hold back their own substantiality. This is how the eyes become transparent, physically transparent. Likewise, through exercises of the will, our soul becomes inwardly transparent. I have only given you a rough idea of things here. You can find extensive details in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. We are, indeed, arriving at a state where we see the world, and without ourselves being an obstacle to this, advance fully into the supra-sensory realm. For actually, because we always live in our body while we are in the ordinary state of consciousness, we are an obstacle to ourselves as far as immersing ourselves in the supra-sensory world is concerned. For the body conveys to us only what is earthly, not what is soul-spiritual. But now, when we can set aside our body, so to speak, we can see into a level of the spiritual world, where there appears before our spiritual gaze what will become of our soul when it has passed through the portal of death. Just as in the other way I described earlier, how we come to know our pre-existing life, so we now come to learn about our life after death. And just as we have schooled ourselves to no longer be distracted by the body, so we now come to understand, because it takes on pictorial form, the process in which we are engaged as we completely discard this physical organism and enter the spiritual soul world with our spiritual soul organism. The demise of our physical existence and the enlivening of our spiritual soul existence, this is what we experience at the third stage of supra-sensory knowledge, at the level I have called intuitive knowledge, intuition. It is only now that we have had this experience of putting ourselves into a spiritual world without being caught up in our subjectivity that we are able to know this spiritual world in its full inner nature. At the stage of inspiration, we still experience this spiritual world through the way it flows into us. Now, however, at the stage of higher intuition, we come to know that world in its full inwardness. And now we look back to what at first appeared to us as a necessity, namely moral intuition. This moral intuition is the only aspect of the spiritual world our ordinary consciousness perceives, if it is properly engaged in the self-reflection of pure thinking. I have described the details in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom. Now, when we advance through imagination and inspiration, and engage in exercises that teach us to completely set ourselves aside and to develop the greatest possible activity of the spiritual soul element, while not being subjective, but becoming objective, to the point where we live in this objectivity itself, only then, when we are thus firmly placed into this objectivity, can we really engage in spiritual science. It is only at that point that we become capable of seeing also the spiritual element that already lives in the physical world. And only then do we gain a real understanding of history. Looking at history as a sequence of external events following one after the other is only a preparation for understanding the spiritual driving forces that live in history. Full understanding of them is only possible through intuitive knowledge. And it is only on this level of intuitive knowledge that we comprehend our own I-being, capital. Initially, our own I-being appears to us as something we cannot comprehend. Just as in a dark room surrounded by light, we see the brightness out of the dark with our eyes. So when we look back at our soul, we can see the thoughts, feel the inner processes, and live in our impulses of will. But our actual I-being is like a dark space in the soul, one that is now being illuminated. And so we come to know our own eternal being. Only at that point can we come to know the human being in such a way as to fully comprehend the human being as a social being, that is, we are now at a point where social agnosticism appears. And at this point, the matter becomes particularly serious, What is social agnosticism? It originates when we seek to apply to social phenomena the mode of observation we have learned to apply, and rightly so, to outer natural phenomena. That has given rise to various compromise theories in the social sciences and in sociology. Indeed, this applies to all theories about social life that have come about so far. What emerges there is a view of social life that starts with a natural scientific approach, and therefore must set aside everything knowable that is foreign to thought and is present only in the instinctive life. The most extreme example of this appeared in Marxism, which considers everything spiritual as an ideology. Marxism wants to see the impulses of social life implemented only if they develop out of the instinct, which for its part belongs to agnosticism. In other words, class consciousness is nothing other than the sum total of what is not rooted in knowledge of the human being, but emerges instead out of the instincts. But those who in certain living conditions develop such instincts must first recognize this. An unbiased look at human social life will tell you that particularly in the social arena, we have arrived at agnosticism. It may seem grotesque and paradoxical to most people these days. But in this area of the humanities, we cannot advance beyond this type of agnostic knowledge unless we rise to truly intuitive knowledge, and thus to the experience of our human essence. Basically, we only pass each other by today. We judge each other based on externals only. Social demands emerge as we develop, especially the old social instincts, most strongly. But if we are to develop an inner social soul mood, the intuitions coming from the spiritual world must permeate us in a living way. In our agnostic age, we necessarily have come to see something spiritual more or less only in ideas. Those ideas, however, if they are in our ordinary consciousness, are not alive. Modern philosophers talk of logical ideas, aesthetic ideas, and ethical ideas. And we can observe all these ideas and experience them inwardly in a theoretical way. But they have no driving force, no momentum for life. These ideas take on real life only when we fight our way up to the intuitive experience of the spiritual. We cannot arrive at social relief and liberation, and we cannot permeate our life with an appropriate religiosity unless we come to an intuitive, living comprehension of the spiritual. This living comprehension of the spiritual is very different from what we now call spiritual life. What we call spiritual life today is actually ideational life, or in other words, life in abstract ideas that cannot serve as impulses. But what intuition provides will once again restore to humanity the living spirit that dwells with us. All we now have are thoughts. And because these are merely and exclusively thoughts, they have lost the spirit entirely. Thus what we have are thoughts as abstractions, and we have to fight to regain the life in our thoughts. This life of thoughts is the spirit that dwells among us, not the spirit we only know about. We cannot develop a social life until the spirit again lives in us, and until we stop trying to design society on an unspiritual foundation, namely, out of what lives in social agnosticism. Instead, we must design society based on the attitude that knows how to regain the living spirit through intuition. We can now look back to earlier ages. It is true, of course, that we have overcome them, and especially those who firmly ground themselves in anthroposophy will be the last to wish those times back in their old form. Nevertheless, despite all their flaws, which are easy to criticize in our time, what those ancient times had is that in certain epochs they brought the living spirit, not just the intellectual spirit, among people. As a result, the already existing basis of knowledge could expand into an artistic comprehension of the world, religious permeation of the inner life, and social design of the world. We will have a new social design of the world, new religious life, and new artistic works, all based on the foundation of knowledge on which, in principle, they have always rested. But we will have all this only if we can regain a living knowledge, so that it is not only just our thoughts that draw their life from the Spirit, but rather the Spirit itself that will live in humanity. This living Spirit is what Anthroposophy seeks. Anthroposophy does not want to be a theory or a theoretical worldview. Anthroposophy wants to be what can activate the Spirit in human life in all its liveliness. That is, Anthroposophy wants to imbue human beings not just with knowledge about the Spirit, but with the Spirit itself. And this is what will take us beyond the age that has allowed phenomenalism to flower and has celebrated its peak. Of course, we can only wish that it continues to flourish, and we can only wish that the way of thinking that has become established in the natural sciences will continue to thrive in the precision and conscientiousness that have become standard. But at the same time, the life of the Spirit must not be limited to living on only in old traditions. Basically, all experiences of the spiritual today are founded on traditions, on the spirituality that humanity attained in earlier times. Our present-day art, for example, is essentially based on traditions that rest on the foundation of what humanity attained in earlier times. Today, we cannot arrive at new styles of architecture unless we transform our consciousness itself. Failing that, we will simply continue to build in the Renaissance, Gothic, and ancient architectural styles and not achieve creative production. We will have creative production only when we enliven knowledge itself inwardly, so that we are not designing and forming just concepts, but inner life that fills us and that can build the bridge between what we comprehend in our thoughts and what we must create in the fullness of life. We must become productive by, above all, seeking to base our life on the foundation of living insight and knowledge. This, ladies and gentlemen and dear students, is what Anthroposophy wants. It wants to bring life into the human soul, into the human spirit, and not to be the opponent, as has often been alleged, of what it is keen to acknowledge as fully legitimate and appropriate in the modern spirit of science. Instead, Anthroposophy wants to continue along the lines of that scientific spirit, so that it can move out of the external, material, and naturalistic into the spiritual soul realm. And all those who in our time can see and understand the needs of human beings in this way are convinced that in many people there already lives an inner unconscious urge toward such a continuation of the spirit of the sciences of our time. What Anthroposophy wants is to shape deliberately, consciously, what lives in many as a vague urge. And only those will see Anthroposophy in the right light and in its right relationship to the sciences who come to know it in its truth and not in the distortions that are so fabricated about it these days. The end of Lecture 7.